Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday afternoon. The headline of today's New York Times, if you've been around as long as I have, it's still incredible news. U.S. will restore full relations with Cuba, erasing a last trace of Cold War hostility. Yesterday, the president announced the restoration of full diplomatic relations with Cuba, the opening of an embassy in Havana for the first time in more than 50 years. It was the result of 18 months of secret negotiations that produced prisoner swaps, and evidently Pope Francis was involved, and so was Canada. We're going to talk about all of this hour. What will be the impact on Cuba, who the Cuban Five are. Our guest has been to Cuba many times and has been studying this issue and really knows what he's talking about. Art Heitzer is with us. Art has practiced civil rights and employment law in Milwaukee since 1975. He's been named among the best lawyers, as well as having been listed in Who's Who in American Law and among super lawyers, graduate of the University of Wisconsin Law School and Marquette. Art has held leadership roles in the Wisconsin Bar Association and the National Lawyers Guild. He chairs its Cuba subcommittee, and he has worked with the Center for Constitutional Rights on behalf of the National Lawyers Guild, helped train and establish a network of over 50 lawyers all over the country to assist travelers from this country who had visited or wanted to visit Cuba. He's been there many times himself, and he has sent for a long time now, in September of 2013, sent an open letter to President Obama as part of a monthly campaign to contact the White House on the 5th of each month, the month marking the 15th anniversary of the Cuban Five arrests in 1998. So we have much to talk about this hour of the program. We'll be welcoming your phone calls as we always do. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Leave messages on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter @KDunnShow. Hello, Art. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you much for inviting me.
You, of all the people I know, understand this issue quite thoroughly. Were you as surprised as many people seemed to be yesterday with the president's announcement?
Pleasantly, but not quite. We were hoping for a Hanukkah surprise, that something would be done so Alan Gross could be back in his family. He's active in Jewish tradition. And so when Hanukkah first happened, I hadn't heard he'd been released, so I said, well, maybe it won't happen. And then early the next morning, people started calling up and said, guess what? Alan Gross is being released, and so are the remaining of the group called the Cuban Five.
Mm-hmm. And what was Alan Gross doing in Cuba? Was he establishing, the news reports have been saying, an internet system that would give access to more people in Cuba?
Well, there's things we know, and as Donald Rumsfeld once said, there's things we know we don't know. So we know he was paid some $500,000 by USAID, which is supposed to build hospitals and schools and do good stuff, but got itself mired in a whole series of attempts to build and promote an opposition movement within Cuba. And as a matter of fact, Mr. Gross went on a hunger strike after the Associated Press revealed some of these AID, USAID schemes that were initiated shortly after he was arrested. So he felt, and he in fact wouldn't see anyone from any U.S. representative for the last 6 months or so, because he said, you really don't seem to care about me. You put me down there. So he was, he barely knew Spanish. He knew nothing about Cuba. He had some expertise in setting up some kind of internet networks. And we know from the AP, at least, that he had technology that is not available. You and I cannot buy it. But CIA and high-level State Department people can have it so that their calls can't be traced. Mm. And he was bringing this equipment, and he was dealing with a Cuban who was a member of Cuban intelligence almost throughout, and said, here is more stuff, where do we go, etc. And on his fifth trip, he was arrested and charged with working for the U.S. government to try to undermine the Cuban Revolution.
And the Cuban Five, three were released along with this exchange. You know a great deal about the Cuban Five that I think most people don't understand, what their background was, why they were imprisoned here, what they were doing.
Well, there's a couple of versions, which is not rare, I guess. in September 1998, these five were arrested along with some other Cuban Americans in South Florida, Miami area. And ultimately, these five refused to turn state's evidence or whatever. They said what we were doing was something we believe in. And they were tried, and they were convicted of everything they were charged with before a Miami jury, which was very controversial, that the judge refused to move it outside of Miami or even to the next county, where a unanimous Court of Appeals decision once said it was a perfect storm of injustice in terms of the prosecution inflaming the passions and the jury already being predisposed to being very anti-Cuban revolution, because these were all definitely agents of Cuba. I mean, the news reports today say that Fidel Castro sent them. I don't know that Fidel Castro had much to do with it, but certainly the government of which, you know, Fidel Castro was head sent these people. Two of them were actually born in the U.S., one born in Chicago. So two were dual U.S. citizens, but they were all raised in Cuba. And they came to South Florida. Their mission, as they say, and there's a definitive book on the subject which from a Canadian journalist which verifies that, was to monitor the activities of extremists within the Cuban-American community in Florida that had a history of terrorism against Cuba. You may or may not know that the first time a civilian airliner was blown up as a victim of terrorism in this hemisphere was a Cuban plane, killed everyone on board. The intellectual authors of that, Orlando Bosch and Luis Posada Carrillo's, Bosch has since died, but he was walking free and continuing to give interviews, encouraging more and more terrorism, while Fernando Gonzalez, one of the Cuban Five, who was assigned to monitor his activities, was sitting and serving his 15-year sentence. Mm. Much of Fernando's sentence was served in Wisconsin, so I got to know him. The other is Luis Posada Carrillo's, who is still walking free in Miami, even though U.S. intelligence and any reasonable source confirms that he hired the people who planted the bombs. They, in fact, testified under oath that he did that. They were given a few years in prison, and he walks free in Miami.
And how did the press play that story when that event happened? How did the American press play it?
When the plane went
yes.
down? Well, you know, I just watched a little clip, I think this morning on Democracy Now, of Cronkite saying a Cuban plane had gone down, there was a bomb, it was an explosion on board, everybody was killed, over 73 people. You know, it takes a while to get the intelligence out, but I have, and I can send to anyone, you know, memos to Kissinger in advance related to an assassination in Washington, D.C., that these folks also claim credit for, and said, next we're going to hit a Cuban airplane, and U.S. did nothing to stop it, did nothing to warn the Cubans, look, you know, you better watch out, someone's going to try and blow up your plane, or more things. I'm not saying that these folks were then employed by the CIA. It's a little unclear. They were clearly trained by the CIA.
Really?
They had been CIA operatives. That's how they knew all the explosive stuff. And they were listed as CIA assets often on, really on either side of this bombing. So you could say they were sent by the CIA, but that's not conclusive.
Mm-hmm.
But they were certainly tolerated. And as I said, now that we see Jeb Bush is probably running for president, he spearheaded the campaign to keep these people, give them asylum, allow them to stay in the United States and not be tried for mass murder, which, in fact, they were guilty of.
Hmm. Tell me about the history, the long, long history of animosity toward Cuba. Obviously, we went through the missile crisis, and those were tense times for this country and for that country as well. But so many people, the most common reaction I've heard since yesterday is, this is long overdue. There's no need to call Cuba a terrorist nation. There's no need to have this kind of animosity and to be giving punitive economic sanctions against this country when we have trade with so many other countries that are communist or whatever system that we don't approve of, we still do business with them. Why haven't we with Cuba? Why so hard to normalize relations?
Well, again, there's several narratives. The most common political science narrative is it's all about Florida, the exile community. Mm-hmm. The original generation was violently I use violently, both literally as and figuratively, against the Cuban Revolution. And that's much less so now. Obama probably carried the Cuban-American vote, carried Florida, even though he had said we should have somewhat more relaxed relations. Charlie Crist carried the Cuban-American vote for governor after saying we should end the embargo, et cetera. So things have changed. But generally it was said, well, you're going to lose Florida if you do anything rational towards Cuba, so don't do it. I think it goes deeper than that. I think that's a factor. But there's a big book historian has written called That Infernal Little Republic. It's about U.S. relations with Cuba. And the general theme of that is that the U.S. has always seen itself as, the nicest word would be protectorate of Cuba, but trying to make sure Cuba is civilized, help those poor people, whatever. Cubans don't necessarily appreciate that. And certainly in the 1959 revolution, led by Fidel Castro and others, they wanted to go their own way. They felt their society was dominated by U.S. business. They generally said that Batista was the most powerful person in Cuba and the U.S. ambassador was the second most powerful. Sometimes people wanted to know maybe those should be reversed. So they wanted to have different priorities. They wanted to have health for everyone, long story there, but very successful, a universal education up to the highest levels. Cuba's population is very highly educated. They don't have the jobs to match, so that's another imbalance. They have a lot of problems. But they had those priorities and felt that the capitalist method, as in terms of the underdevelopment of Latin America and in Cuba, was not the way to get there. And very rapidly, the U.S. government decided it should try to destroy that revolution and has tried in various means ever since, and maybe now has decided to give up on that project. Mm.
And when did the relationship develop and the strong relationship between Cuba and Russia, Soviet Union?
Yeah, I mean, it's by the way, if any of your listeners were watching MSNBC last night, I'd be interested in their take, because that's, I had to watch one channel, so I watched, you know, three or four of their different anchors and what their take was on it. And how they mix up, Chris Matthews in particular was problematic, how they mix up the order of things. So it was, you know, Cuba, Castro takes over, they ally with Russia, we have to have the Bay of Pigs, right, et cetera, et cetera. The history, I think, is clearly not that. It's that Cuba had a popular revolution from the grounds up, was certainly going to be in some conflict with the U.S. businesses that controlled their economy, and was looking for other options. And then various means, you know, there's a British film called 638 Ways to Kill Castro. I mean, there were many, many attempts to do things like that. And so the Cuban government under Fidel Castro decided that they should take up some offers from the Soviet Union for some kind of protection. And so that developed, and then, of course, we have the Cuban Missile Crisis. We have the Bay of Pigs before that. Bay of Pigs was a, you know, that was maybe one of my, you know, I was born in 1947, so in 61, shortly after John F. Kennedy took over, when I was 13 years old, I went out and volunteered to work for Kennedy as a Catholic working class person in Wauwatosa. So the news said that there was this invasion, and Hadley Stevenson went before the UN and said, the U.S. has nothing to do with it, whatever. This is all crazy Cuban hysteria and propaganda. These are just Cubans trying to take their country back. And it flopped. They expected, the CIA told Kennedy that people were going to revolt. And instead, the people grabbed their rifles and went to defend their country. And the U.S. napalmed them, which is not well known, but it's documented. And so they didn't revolt, and they were all mopped up, so over 1,000 of these, whatever you want to call them, invaders were seized. And then Kennedy did a very interesting thing, a very gutsy thing. He went on TV and he said, I take full responsibility for this. His popularity went way up because here's finally someone who didn't pass the bucket on to somebody else, passed the bucket. But I know my mother and I, you know, just sort of said, well, we don't quite understand. Last week, we read all over that we had nothing to do with it, and today the president said it's all his fault. And that was the beginning of, you could tell, there was a couple levels of truth going around, and they did not always fit together.
Mm-hmm. And what about the impact of our relations and an economic embargo and a travel embargo for all these years on Cuba? Has it made a significant difference in levels of poverty that we hear are present in Cuba? Does our relationship make a difference in that regard on the everyday lives of Cubans?
Well, I think certainly it does. But the question is, you know, we don't have a control group. So we know, there's at least two narratives. One is that the U.S., they call it an economic blockade with some justification we can get into perhaps. But the U.S. embargo or economic blockade, the economic warfare against Cuba basically, is responsible for all sorts of shortages and dysfunctions, et cetera. That's the official narrative you will hear in Cuba. You will hear in the U.S. people will say, well, really, it's totally ineffective. They can buy from other countries. It's that the Cuban system is so inefficient and corrupt, and it's all their fault. And both those are factors. And I don't think anybody in the world can tell you which is the 90% or 10% or 50-50. We do know this, that back to 1960, official U.S. policy was, and I can read a direct quote, but that the Castro government was very popular. The only way that we can displace them is, and
yeah, it's interesting to read it.
This is was April 6, 1960. The only foreseeable means of alienating internal support is through disenchantment and disaffection based on economic dissatisfaction and hardship. And that would justify U.S. policy seeking, quote, to bring about hunger, desperation, and overthrow of government, period, end quote. Hmm. And that is not much known by the populace in this
country.
That was
a policy established when, Art?
That's April 1960. Hmm. So the Cuban Revolution took power January 1, basically, of 59. Mm-hmm. So you have within about a year a policy that we will try to impose on the Cuban people, hunger, hardship, desperation, because that's the only way we think they will then have enough dissension that they will overthrow the Cuban Revolution, because otherwise it seems to be popular. And that really has been our policy in different modes. Sometimes it was terrorism and blowing up things and sabotage, of which there was a lot. Sometimes it was trying to prevent third countries from trading with Cuba, which has really gotten worse under Obama. Not necessarily that he sat down and said, I want to prevent companies in Ireland from trading with Cuba, but they have the software and the banking penalties, etc. So there's a bank in France that was fined $9.2 billion earlier this year because they were handling interactions with sanctioned nations, including Cuba. Shortly after that, the Bank of Ireland wrote to all of their customers who have legal trade businesses legal with Cuba and said, we cannot handle your accounts anymore. Go somewhere else. Hmm. We're afraid of being fined. Bank in Switzerland fined over $2 billion, et cetera. So there's many other specific aspects, but the ability of Cuba to trade with other countries, if some product has a significant U.S. component in it, it's illegal for that country to sell it. Same thing if Cuba cannot sell anything to the U.S., basically. So one of their few natural resources is nickel, which is a component of solder, of course. So if the solder gets into a Japanese or a Korean VCR, and then they want to sell it in the U.S., well, maybe we can, maybe we can't, so we're going to tell the Cubans, we'll pay you half the world market price because it's going to be a hot item, and it's a big, big headache, and you think about it. And the Cubans say, well, I guess we have no choice. Mm-hmm.
So what happened yesterday changes all of that? I'm confused about this. Or do you need congressional approval in order to change those kinds of incredible restrictions?
Yeah. So that's a very good question. So most of it, I think, did not change and probably cannot change without congressional action. There is some range of views among lawyers as to how much the Obama administration could do if they really want to push the executive authority to the edge. As we know, there's been a big fight over the undocumented people in the United States who have been low prioritized so they won't be deported, and people say, oh, that's terrible. How can you not enforce every law to the hilt? you know, and running around and deport 14 million people. So you have the same kind of issues there, how much can be done by administrative regulation. What happened yesterday is the announcement that there will be formal diplomatic relations between the U.S. and Cuba, so there'll be embassies as opposed to what we have right now, which are sort of non-embassies. The travel restrictions cannot go away. It will still be illegal to for a U.S. person to go to be a tourist. Or
oh, it will be.
Congress will have to change
that.
I
see.
But what does tourism mean? You give me a definition. So you go down to a country, you mix it up with the people, you learn from them, you go to the museums, etc. You know, that's my kind of tourism. Now, there are a lot of people go to Cuba from Canada, Europe, etc. They go in, you know, capsules, like people go down to Cancun, where they're only on the beach. You know, they pay so much, they have a little wristband. They can drink all they want, have salsa lessons, you know.
Right.
And they never get outside of that.
Right.
And a week later, you know, they bring some good books and they go home. That's tourism, I guess. But beyond that, I'm not sure you can even define what it really means. But so all the categories, professional research, journalism, religious, many other categories, including one called person-to-person educational, those will all become general license. And this gets technical, but in shorthand is people will not have to apply for these licenses in advance. They will just have to fulfill the requirements. But no one's really going to know. They'll come back. If the government made a high priority of Marco Rubio becomes president or something and he wants to hire 10,000 people to chase after everyone who went to Cuba and, you know, subpoena them to come in and put them under oath and have people following them around in Cuba, then maybe you could build a case. But otherwise, it'll be unenforceable. So as a practical matter, freedom of U.S. people to travel to Cuba will be there, not as a matter of law, but as a practical matter.
Well, how about baseball? I mean, what about scouting baseball players? Or if you wanted to have spring training in Havana?
Well, there have been some Little League exchanges, by the way.
Have there?
Right. And some discussion here in Milwaukee. And I should also tell you that there's a Harley-Davidson club that's active in Cuba.
Is it really?
But I don't think they're able to get any Harleys, you know, since 1960 or so, but maybe they got some from Japan somewhere and just put the name tag on. And I didn't read it. One of the articles that was in the New York Times has had a big emphasis on this issue in the last couple of months. And one of the articles was specifically how this will affect Cuban baseball scouting. Because we have stars here and throughout the major leagues who are wonderfully talented Cuban baseball players.
Right. We're going to welcome phone calls for Art. Here's our phone number. We're talking about the announcement yesterday the U.S. will restore full relations with Cuba. And Art is talking about the intricacies, what will take place immediately, what needs congressional approval. And we have yet to talk about why this happened right now. Maybe it's because Art wrote so many letters, right? It could be. I don't know. Here's how you reach our conversation. Art has been interested in working on this issue, normalization of relations, for a long time. He's an attorney practicing civil rights and employment law in Milwaukee. He has held leadership roles in the Wisconsin Bar Association and the National Lawyers Guild. He chairs for the Lawyers Guild, the Cuba Subcommittee. He works with the Center for Constitutional Rights and has trained over 50 lawyers in this country to assist travelers from America who had visited or wanted to visit Cuba. Here is our phone number. He also has written a legal analysis of the U.S. economic blockade and a detailed review of the case of the Cuban Five. And here's how you reach us. What do you think of the announcement yesterday? Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can also find us on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. To your calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about Cuba, restoring full relations. The United States will, with the president's and President Raul Castro's announcement yesterday. Art Heitzer is our guest. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. And we start, Art, with Rick in Delafield. Hi, Rick.
Hello. Thank you.
Thank you, Rick. Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know why we don't have relations with Cuba. Wisconsin trades a lot of agriculture products, and the reason it's just ignorance that we don't trade with the world. I mean, and there's a big, beautiful island south of us. It's all political, the reason why we don't trade with them. I mean, there's no reason why we wouldn't.
Thanks very much for your call. Do you know why all of this happened now, and was the Pope and the Canadian government very instrumental in all of this happening now?
Well, I don't know the full backstory, but there's two things that are very clear. One is that in April, it's called the Summit of the Americas, all the countries from the Western Hemisphere are going to be meeting together. The U.S. has always tried to keep Cuba from coming. And in the last couple of years, more and more countries said, we're not going to go anymore if Cuba isn't there. Everybody voted, maybe the Harper government in Canada voted with us, but everybody else said, Cuba's got to come or we're not ever going to meet again.
Hmm.
And so the president of Panama, and Panama's not got a leftist government or anything, he went personally to invite Raul Castro about a month ago and said, you got to come. And Raul said, okay, I'm going to come. And so you had the awkward thing of the U.S. and Obama being there and either having done some movement on this issue after 6 years in office, as he said he basically would in his campaign, or the rest of the hemisphere kind of looking at putting Obama in the corner with a dunce cap on and say, what's wrong with you?
Mm-hmm.
So that was one issue, and the New York Times certainly is focused on that. The other is the situation with Alan Gross. He's not a young person. He's lost some teeth. He's lost a lot of weight. And he was getting very despondent. As I might have said, he felt the U.S. government was so not caring for him that he refused to see any more representatives from the U.S. government the last 6 months or so.
Mm-hmm.
He said, this will be my last year, dead or alive. People thought he might want to commit suicide. He actually went on, I think, two hunger strikes. One right after the Associated Press publicized that USAID had launched another one of these, you could call it crazy if you're charitable, programs to try to foment opposition in Cuba right after he was arrested as a USAID person saying, I'm innocent, I'm just, you know, bringing laptops to Cuba, what's wrong with this? And Hillary Clinton and others saying, yeah, what's wrong with that? Of course, at the same time, as Obama even noted in his speech, the U.S. has tried to prevent Cuba from getting current technology. And then instead of just letting it be in the open market, we'll try and prevent that. And then we'll secretly send people in and say that they're trying to get laptops to people in Cuba. But it was really much higher tech stuff that couldn't couldn't be traced, etc.
Thanks for the call, Rick. Tim in Eau Claire. Hi, Tim.
Hi, I guess I'm just wondering timelines. How long until we start seeing an influx of banned Cuban goods, particularly cigars, which I'm sure is on a lot of people's mind? And secondary, how long until we get to pack our bags and go visit?
Well, those are two questions. I guess the technical answer, it depends how long it takes for them to rewrite the regulations, which hopefully they've started working on, but I don't know that. And in terms of bringing back the tobacco and the, if you want to engage in tobacco, and the rum. In terms of going, there are, we have a coalition to normalize relations with Cuba. On our website, we have a whole section of trips to Cuba that are licensed, and that's been true for quite a while. Our website is wicuba.org, so abbreviation for Wisconsin, W-I, and then cuba.org. But they've been pretty pricey, the truth of the matter is. It's a longer story than maybe we want to go into, but the people that do not want U.S. people to see what's going on in Cuba directly have pressured the Obama administration not to renew licenses for such trips. And then finally they did. It's a 100-page application, and it requires the sponsor, the U.S. sponsor, to monitor the activities of every U.S. traveler every 15 minutes and keep those records for 6 years. Cuba, in fact, does not have minders. Maybe North Korea does or whatever, I don't know, but Cuba doesn't. So you go there, you can, unless you get on a military base, it's not an issue. But the U.S. government imposes on, whether it's the National Geographic or whatever, that they're supposed to say, oh, from 8 in the morning until 8 at night, we're going to watch to make sure And I tell people they shouldn't have to worry about it. But since November 2006, so that's when the Democrats did well in the off election, so it's the last 2 years of Bush, all enforcement against individual travelers to Cuba stopped. Huh. It was never announced. We are in the guidebooks and the websites, and we figured we got maybe at least one out of three people who were being harassed by the U.S. government would call us and say, can you help? And that just stopped.
Hmm. Interesting. Who is the unnamed U.S. spy who's been in Cuba for 20 years who was also released?
I don't know much about him. Newsweek has come up with a name. It's not been a publicized matter generally before this. He has described in MSNBC and others, Rachel Maddow had a long thing on his role, supposedly, that he was in the center of Cuban intelligence and was a CIA asset and told them about all sorts of different people who were aiding Cuba in terms of intelligence and led to a number of arrests. And so he's considered, described as being a really key asset, I guess, who's been in prison maybe for 20 years.
Mm-hmm. And what about, you mentioned, and a lot has been said about the fact that we've tried all of these things for all of these years, and yet that stated purpose to make people so hungry and disenchanted that they would want to have a revolution again in Cuba has not happened. Why hasn't that happened? Has there been dissatisfaction? People are they may be well-educated, but as you said, they don't have great jobs. The economy is not terrific. Is there widespread satisfaction with the government, or have there been attempts to put in something else over all these years?
Well, there's been many experiments. I mean, griping is universal, commonplace, you know. Supposed to get paper towels at this place, rush over there, and, you know, you get there 10 minutes late after the line goes down and they're all out or whatever. So you have, you know, there's many transformations, but it's basically been a very egalitarian society, but not a very rich one. So they put all their resources into health, education, a good sports program. So you got over 1 million college grads. You may or may not know this. Cuba is generally viewed as having the highest doctor-patient ratio in the world. They have 50,000, currently, 50,000 medical professionals serving abroad. Mm. It's not in Cuba. Mm. This is just in other countries. Mm-hmm. And Cuba's roughly double the population of Wisconsin. So can you imagine if Wisconsin at any one time had 25,000 medical professionals serving in West Africa and South America, et cetera, and Pakistan after the earthquake? So, you know, Cuba's very, very strong in some areas. And people say human capital. I don't quite like to use that phrase, but their people are their asset. They don't have much in other resources.
Thanks for your call, Tim. Let's go next to Jim in Hollandale. Hi, Jim.
Afternoon. You're much more of a historian than I am, but I'm in my mid-60s, and it seems to me that one of the main reasons that Batista got tossed out was because the Cubans were kind of disgusted with the way that there were big American corporations running Cuba. United Fruit Company was one of them, and they got when they got thrown out. That I always thought that that had a great deal to do with our attitude toward Cuba, and as far as that goes, with the rest of Central America, with United Fruit Company now United Brands, I guess. But what do you know about all that?
Well, I think that's quite an accurate narrative. There is a detailed book, Cuba and the U.S., a chronological history by Jane Franklin. You can actually get it online on Jane Franklin's website that goes through every day what happened. And you will see exactly what you said in great detail. I will say that the Cuban Revolution was, you know, I'm a peace person. I don't much believe in picking up the gun and all that sort of stuff. But they felt, based on the history of Latin America, you know, Che Guevara was in Guatemala when they had an elected government that went against United Fruit by United Fruit standards. It was intolerable by their standards, but most of the people in the country supported it. But the CIA organized a coup, overthrew the government. Tens of thousands, if not more, you know, people massacred in in the decades since then in Guatemala, indigenous, you know, villages totally wiped out, etc. So Che was there, as was Father Bill Brennan from Milwaukee, passed away a few months ago, and basically said, this path is not the path. We have to find some way to get power, and just electing people to the U.S. won't allow a government like that to survive. So they, a few of them, not very many, survived, made it to eastern part of Cuba and went to the peasants and said, this is what we stand for. You don't have a doctor here. You've probably never seen a doctor because you're not in a big city. The government doesn't care about you. It's very corrupt. And we're willing to fight and die for this cause. And after not very long, they had armies of over 5,000 people. When Batista's troops would come, their policy was that if they would capture someone, if they were wounded, they would nurse them back to health, and then they would release them. Because they felt, apparently accurately, that they were on the side with the Cuban people. And so the Batista soldiers would go back and say, these people aren't so bad. Why should I risk my life for this dictator in Havana when, you know, they're risking their lives so people will have a little better, you know, distribution of resources? And pretty soon Batista's army had just dissolved.
Thanks very much for the call. How do you think, Art, as we approach a Republican Senate and House, all of this is going to play out politically? Did you hear what you thought would be a huge amount of Republican upset? Rubio, we know, was taking the microphone. McConnell has expressed some displeasure. Is this going to be an issue that will grow among Republicans? There won't be any possibility of truly open trade? Or was it kind of smaller than you thought, the opposition?
Oh, I think standard fare is what I would say. Mm-hmm. You know, Marco Rubio, I mean, they did a pretty good job on one of the MSNBC shows last night of just Lawrence O'Donnell, I think, showing how he and Eliana Ross Litton, who are the far out people in terms of Congress, totally anti-anything towards normalizing with Cuba. And they're against anyone, congressional representative or anyone else going to Cuba because they think everybody lives in cages. I guess that was the reference that Rubio described it. And maybe not literally, but that's the reference he used. And meanwhile, both of them sent their staff to China, paid solely by the Chinese government. And then when Rubio was asked to explain, his spokesperson said, well, China's really big and Cuba's pretty small.
He was small.
And right. China's really big and Cuba's pretty small.
Let's go next to Mary in Eau Claire. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I was just wondering, when your guest, I'm sorry, I forgot his name.
Art Heitzer.
Talked about the two people being in charge before the revolution as being Batista and the American ambassador, and I remember from The Godfather that Meyer Lansky was down there and that the mafia really had a lot to do with the running of Cuba, and I wondered if you could say anything about that.
Well, quite true. Another grievance that the, I'll call them the rebels, had against the corrupt government there. And you know, Cuba was viewed in some ways as America's whorehouse, and people would go down there for sex, booze, gambling, etc. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a whole series of some films. Former Milwaukeean did some really good films, Jeannie Weissman, on what Cuba did in terms of women who were in the sex trade and how they were then educated and, you know, talks about a number of their lives, etc. So, yeah, people were demeaned in many ways, and certainly the mafia, we'll call them, the organized crime figures from the U.S., did not appreciate the Cuban Revolution because the Cuban Revolution closed the casinos and basically said, you guys, time to go home. And they didn't really like that.
Thanks very much for your call, Mary. And another Mary in Milwaukee. Hi, Mary.
Good afternoon. Quick question. How will the current change in policies affect the movement of illicit drugs from South and Central America up to Cuba and then into the United States? I'll take my answer off the phone.
All right, Mary.
Well, that's a good question. So there's many, many contradictions, but one of the contradictions is assuming that the U.S. government is very strong anti-drug, the Cuban government is also, whereas many of the whatever progressive leftist governments in South America that are friends with Cuba are saying the drug war is a failure, let's stop it. So I doubt that there is a significant drug trade coming into the U.S. from Cuba. Cuba monitors it, you know, as much as they can, and they don't want to have a drug issue or drug problem there. So one of the areas for cooperation that Obama, I think, referenced specifically and that many of us have urged, you know, there's a lot of times that Cuba has given information to the U.S. about things, and the U.S., you know, maybe the person who gets it says thank you, but beyond that, the U.S. has just cold-shouldered Cuba in return. This is something, drug trafficking is certainly an issue that both sides can cooperate together. Mm.
Thanks for your call, Mary. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Art Heitzer is our guest this hour, and we're talking about yesterday's historic announcement on the part of the President of the United States and the President of Cuba that the U.S. will restore full relations with Cuba, what that means, what still needs congressional approval, and we're touching on some of the very long history here. Art is a lawyer. He's a civil rights and employment lawyer here in Milwaukee, and he's been involved in this issue for a long time. He is with the National Lawyers Guild and chairs the Cuba subcommittee for that guild and has done a lot of work in all of these areas. More phone calls momentarily. One line is open if you'd like to join us. 800-486-8655 is our number. You can always leave messages on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We'll return to you in a moment here on the Ideas Network. You know, for as long as I've known you, Art, you've been involved in issues relating to the U.S. and Cuban relations, and I'm wondering how that came about in your life. Why?
Well, I went to college at the time of the Vietnam War, and a lot of things we were told then, you know, I assume defeating communism is a easy issue, nothing to debate there, you know, whatever it takes, and after a while found out that our government was trying to prevent free elections in Vietnam, and because we knew Ho Chi Minh would win and stuff like that. So there was a major rethinking process going on among millions of young people at that point, including myself. And I always wanted to kind of root for the underdog. So I went to Cuba right before I ended up in law school trying to decide whether I should go to law school or not. That was a total failure. I came back, and I still didn't know what I should do, but I staggered into law school, but I was there for 2 months. This was 1972. We had Cuban and North Americans, and a lot of the North American group I was with were Puerto Ricans, and we built prefab housing. We saw the value of a little bit of mechanization because we didn't have much, and we kept on digging these ditches and by hand and shovel and axe, and didn't get very far, to be honest. But at any rate, I went back when Jimmy Carter was president. He allowed basically legal travel to Cuba for a while until Reagan got in. So the first trip, legal trip from the U.S., which was O'Hare to Cuba, I was on that in 78. And then I didn't go back for quite a while until 1994, when all the prevailing wisdom in the U.S. was that Cuba is not going to survive. You know, you can go to the library and probably find a shelf full of books by Oppenheimer, who runs the Spanish-oriented PBS show, and Eugene Robinson from Washington Post, who's a MSNBC guy, was on last night. He, you know, The Last Dance in Cuba, you know, titles like this. They were all sure that the Cuban Revolution couldn't survive more than a year or two, and many of us, you know, thought that was probably true, too. So in 94, we went down. It was severe. They had lost maybe 75-80% of their foreign trade, which was predominantly with Soviet Union and their allies, and who had disappeared and torn up the agreements overnight. And the economy itself shrunk by at least a third. And life was very tough. You know, we had a very good friend who was a professor of English at the University of Havana. She was, you know, rather old, and she had lost 30 pounds.
Oh, goodness.
And that was common. Hmm. Nobody was starving to death, but everybody was hungry. And the contrast between that and the fact that the people that we met at parties and various things said, we're not going to give up. You know, a lot of people had just come back from Angola, where they'd been fighting against the South African apartheid troops and, in fact, defeated them. And they said, we are going to persevere no matter what it takes. The largest organization in Cuba is the Cuban Union of Inventors, which are people that that make, you know, the 1954 Chevy still work by finding an old Soviet tractor transmission and somehow sticking it in so it works. They're very resilient. They're very proud. They really didn't want someone telling them, this is, we've made this plan for you, and you better take it or else. And so, and they were still so generous. I mean, they had very little. We were pushing a truck that got stuck on the Malecón, which is like the lakefront here. And the truck went putt, putt, putt away. And so there were some two Cuban guys and us, and where there we were standing there, and the truck was putting away. So they invited us over for dinner a couple of days. And at that point, there was a schedule, 8 hours, there would be no electricity in your neighborhood, and then it would be turned on in some other neighborhood. So we went over there. Everything was dark. It was, you know, we could hear bongo drums and stuff. So very mellow. But we went up, you know, about five or six stories. And then at 8 o'clock, all the electricity went on in their neighborhood. But no fear or anything. People were very mellow. And then we had dinner, and they had lobster for us, which meant they got it on the black market, because that's basically for tourists. And they had a loaf of bread. You can't see it on the radio, but like...
A little loaf of bread.
I mean, like any dinner roll. Mm-hmm. It was a dinner roll. It wasn't. Yeah. But they treated it like a loaf of bread. Uh-huh. So they sliced it, slice. So we have this little sliver of bread, and everybody would get this little sliver of bread. Had that kind of generosity and sharing, and then knowing that our country was, for, you know, these 50 years, trying to impose hunger on them so they would revolt, and that they were hungry. So we came back in 94 and said, well, we've got to do something. So a bunch of people from different experiences like that founded a coalition 20 years ago. So not telling the Cuban people what their government should be, but saying that's their business. We should stop trying to impose hardship on them to force them to do one thing or the other.
Let's go back to phone calls. Mark in Winona, Minnesota. Hi.
Hi, Art. Say, over the years, I've read little tidbits about U.S. criminals using Cuba as a safe haven. Is that true? And if so, now with the normalization processes, that can our law enforcement go after those guys and bring them back for prosecution? I'll take your comments up here.
Sure. So with the exception of people who've gotten asylum, which is a number of people, there have been, like you said, U.S. criminals who figure they go to Cuba, no one could reach them. And by and large, they have been processed out of Cuba in the past. I'm not aware, other than those with asylum who are still there now.
Paul actually emailed this question. Are there any books, Art, that, or there are many, I'm sure, you can particularly recommend?
Well, I mentioned that Infernal Little Republic is by Lars Schultz. I think it's S-C-H-O-O-U-L-T-Z.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned Jane Franklin. This is not, you know, it's all chronology, but it's very, very interesting. U.S. And Cuba chronological history. If you're interested in the Cuban Five, Stephen Kimber, K-I-M-B-E-R. It's called Across the Water. It's the definitive work on the Cuban Five. But it puts it in the context that most of us don't know about of the Cuba says that they have 3,500 people died from terrorism and 2,000 permanently injured on top of that. It puts it in the general context of what it's like to be in a little country next to the strongest, most powerful economically and military country in the world, which is continually dedicated by its policy, at least, even if most of us don't realize it, to its overthrow.
Time for maybe one or two quick phone calls. Melody in Ferryville. Hi, Melody.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay, how are you?
I'm good. I would just like to mention that I was a UAW member, and I worked for General Motors for 30-some years, and Art Heitzer's name brought fear into the minds of employers and comfort into the hearts of workers. Art Heitzer, along with the old guys, Leonard Zabransky and them, if it wasn't for them, I don't know where the workers in Milwaukee would be. Thank you very much. I know it's not about Cuba, but Art Heitzer, kudos to you, sir.
That's very kind. I'll do a really quick car thing. So John Conyers from Detroit issued a very nice statement supporting what Obama did. A number of years ago, Cuba wanted to buy a bunch of Chryslers. They couldn't buy them from the U.S. because of the embargo, so they had to buy Chryslers that were made in Argentina.
Oh.
So we could have jobs. We could have lots more jobs Cuba would like to buy from the U.S. Hmm. Right now, Cuba can't sell anything to the U.S., so it's hard for them to buy things. They can buy, technically, agricultural products, but nothing else. Obama hopefully will push what he can in terms of administrative rules, but Congress will have to step up too. Thanks.
Thanks very much for the call. Nice call for you to hear and the perfect person to have on today. Thank you, Art, very much for being with us. It was a very interesting hour and went by quickly. Art Heitzer, our guest this hour. Art is a lawyer here in Milwaukee. He's a civil rights and employment lawyer, has been since 1975 when he started, repeatedly named among the best lawyers. He's who's who in American law, and he has held leadership roles, Wisconsin Bar Association and the National Lawyers Guild. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and Scotty Myers.